I'm Robin.
And I'm Molly.
And this is
Home is Where the Murder Is.
Welcome.
Hi there, everyone.
So here we are. This is the episode after the
what happened in Mount Moriah.
There it is. And we've been getting asked what's going on and how you're doing.
Yep.
I think we should just get right into that. Tell everybody how you're doing.
Yep. I'm fine. My family is okay. And it was a lot this past week. And the community is going to continue to have to heal and kind of piece itself together after everything that happened. I recently started working at the high school, as we've talked about. So that was back in January. And I work in I'm one of the admins there. So I work back in one of the offices that actually lets people in and out. So I'm actually in charge of like kind of pushing one of the hold buttons, like lockdown buttons and everything too. So we do drills and everything, which is why we do the drills and everything to make sure that we're prepared for days like this. Heaven forbid they ever happen, and one did. So it was a really scary day. And at first when it happened, you didn't know what was going on. And then you got word of that it was an actual thing, not a drill. We heard over the loudspeaker, this is not a drill. You know, everyone needs to get in the rooms. They need to barricade. They need to, you know, this is not a drill, basically. So we were lucky that it wasn't worse. But at the same time, one community member did lose his life. And that's really sad. No matter what, he was a member of someone's family. He was a friend. He was a student. He was someone's, you know, child. So we're really sad about that. So, yeah. But I'm doing okay. It comes and goes in waves of emotions because it was a really frightening day. And my kids were stuck in lockdown, you know, for hours and hours with their classmates. Luckily, they're little, you know. They were at the other schools that weren't my little boy, who's in kindergarten, was pretty away from the situation, a little more across town. Fletcher was kind of on within the campus area more, but they were evacuated to a different area, and but they were okay. All Keaton knows, I mean, they both know what happened because I asked them, you know, what do you know about the day? Because I want to know what they know about the day because they're going to be going back to school. Kids talk, they're going to be talking about it, you know. So they both know what happened, which is fine, you know, because they're going to hear adults talking. They're going to hear kids talking. You know, the day happened and it's not going to go away, you know. People will be talking about it forever because it's something that happened
in our small town.
In our small town. You know, like I said, you know, you always think, you know, oh, that's not gonna happen here, not in our town.
I never would have thought.
You never would have thought. You know that it could happen, but you don't think it's gonna happen. Well,
even with having a murder podcast and everything, everything crosses my mind at least once. But I gotta be honest with you. That was one thing. If it were something that was on the forefront of my mind, I would have never been like, yeah, Molly, take that job at the high school.
Yeah.
Because now I have a new fear unlocked.
Right.
So.
Yep. And yeah, it wasn't at the high school. It was over at the middle school that everything kind of went down. But yeah, I know a lot of students are going to have a lot of long-term effects. A lot of staff and teachers will. A lot of parents will. So.
Yeah. But this town.
Yeah.
Look how we all came together.
Yeah. But there's a lot of.
Local businesses took kids in that ran from the schools and hid them, let them call their parents, call 911. They fed them. Local businesses donated food to the kids that were stuck in school or stuck in the schools because like you didn't get out till 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So this happened at lunchtime.
Some people were even later just because they were still at the schools or the bus garages and stuff. So.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's
And there's been people bringing in therapy dogs and people
I
just like donating that, you know, which is what they do. Yeah. But, you know, it's just, the outreach has been really great.
This is great. So. Yeah. There's a logo going around.
Yeah. That's Robin created that and all her worry. And
I did. It was, I had really bad anxiety when I found out about this. I drove from Mount Horeb or from Milwaukee to Mount Horeb. I didn't really pack a bag or anything. I just kind of grabbed my keys from in my pocket, grabbed my phone, and out the door I went. And then I cried for the entire almost 2-hour drive.
Yeah.
Which at that time, when I finally got on the road, I knew you were safe. You had text me that you were safe or whatever, but it still wasn't like enough.
Right.
And then I got there and, you know, Matt took the puppy, which we still haven't even talked about the fact that you have a puppy yet on here because we haven't had, but we will in a second. Yeah. But Matt took the puppy up to Driftless. Your boys were still in lockdown. You were still in lockdown. So I took Dakota for a long walk.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know what else to do with myself until finally she took herself home.
Yeah.
She was like, all right, lady, this is enough. But then I went for another walk. And then I went for a drive. Then I went uptown and just walked around aimlessly. Didn't know what to do with myself. I started baking, started cleaning, things I never would normally do.
Right.
But I didn't know what to do with myself.
Right.
And then finally I got the Canva out and I played around with a little logo thing. I put a heart over our mascot and just kind of made it my profile picture, you know, just like a little like anxiety thing. And now it's everywhere.
It is.
And I love it. I think it's so cool, but it's also like that's my anxiety staring at my face everywhere I go. But it's nice. But our community is freaking awesome.
It is. I love our town and everyone's been really awesome. And I everyone I worked with that day just amazing, like how everyone came together and just did everything. Anyone that needed anything, they were there for. I mean, it didn't matter if it wasn't your job, it was your job. I mean, just everyone did amazing, and all the police officers. Oh, I mean,
the staff, the police, this
everyone is
the one thing you always want in this situation is for everyone to walk away without being harmed. And that's exactly what Mount Horeb did.
Yep.
Like, this town deserves a big-ass medal or something. Because
and like I said, I mean, everyone except the subject in question.
Of course. And that's, and that's a different scenario.
Yep.
But, it's everything that was planned and trained for was followed appropriately.
Which is why we had the drills and everything. And we have an officer on our campus. And I'm so thankful for him that he was there. Mm-hmm. And I mean, and I, so everything, you know, we'll be fine and it'll take some healing and some time for our community and everyone involved. But I'm very thankful that everything was how it was and that there wasn't more that could have happened.
Yeah.
So,
and thank you to our listeners too. Thank you for reaching out. That was amazing of you guys to do that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, our community is very tight, but everybody around us as well has come forward. We were just talking about how someone's soccer team played, the Mount Horeb soccer team youth played a game.
Yeah, one of the girls' teams.
Yep, and the other team brought them flowers,
yeah.
you know. And then we have neighboring towns that are changing their business pages to our new our logo.
A local in Verona, there was a group that like made like these cute little like craft flowers and they were selling them and any money they got.
Yep.
And they were donating to Mount Horeb for them to use however they needed to.
Yep. Yeah, so. There was there's a couple of people that live throughout the state that want to get those placards. And I was like, well, I drive all over the place anyway. I'll drive some up to you. So we're doing that. But it just goes to show you that it doesn't matter where you live. You could live anywhere in the world and show your support and be there. It's amazing.
Yeah.
So thank you to you guys as well. That was amazing for you guys to reach out. I was blown away by that, to be honest with you.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. I'm a pretty strong person. I didn't really cry that day. I was shaking. Yeah. I was like shaking, but the adrenaline took over that day.
Well, and it's
someone that keeps my shit together.
You're a mama bear,
you know?
That's what I love about you.
I mean, at the end of the day, we had a bunch of students in the school that we had to keep our shit together for, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
Like our first priority was keeping everyone in our school safe.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. And calm.
And calm and
that's
protected.
Huge. Which is one of the reasons that Robin cannot work in a setting like that. Because I could not, I mean, I couldn't even look at your kids when they came home. I had to walk into a different room.
Yep.
And they were fine. Like, they were like,
totally.
But and I'm just like, And you're, and Matt was, you could tell Matt was shaken up. So him and I looked at each other and I'm like, I can't look at you either. Like, I'm just going to.
It was a hard day for Matt. I think it was hard that he didn't have me around or the boys around. Yep. And he was just so.
Yeah.
Everything was so unknown. He kept on obviously messaging me thinking I had more information than I did. Yep. And I really didn't.
Well, and that's tough too, because you were in a, by yourself in, what was it, a windowless room for a long time.
Yeah, over an hour.
Yeah. So, what, I mean, the fear for that amount of time, I don't like it.
Yeah. No, so. It was a lot. And I even turned the lights off and, just because we didn't know at that time if there was more than one person or, we just didn't know. Yeah. So.
No, definitely. And props to the superintendent and the principals and everybody for doing a great job of getting everyone through that day. I'm just, again, so proud of the staff and everything, but the higher ups, I think, handled everything with class and.
I'm really proud to work with the people I work with. Everyone did.
You should be.
So great. I mean, the front office staff, I love everyone I work with.
Yeah.
I'm super lucky to be with who I'm with.
Yeah.
So, and all the teachers and all the support staff and everyone. I mean, everyone really stepped up that day and I hope we never have to do it again.
Right.
I know if we do have to do it again, that we can.
Well, you know.
I know.
Mount Horeb.
I know.
We got it. I mean, they fucking A.
Yep.
Mount Horeb. Fucking A.
That's the new logo.
The new logo.
I think that they won't put that on shirts. I don't think for
that's
everyone.
Gonna fly.
Nope. We'll leave that off. But yeah.
Do we have anything funny to talk about?
I don't.
Have I done anything stupid lately?
No. You ate a whole chicken in your worry.
I did. Oh, yeah. When I was having my anxiety, I did. I bought a rotisserie chicken and started eating it with my bare hands in my car. Mm-hmm. I did that. That was... I learned that I had new forms of stress that I did. Because I've never been afraid of something bad happening to you. You don't really do anything that's too dangerous.
No, I don't. So, I'm a pretty safe person.
It was a pretty, all these new fears got unlocked all at the same time. And I was like, and all these like things kept rushing through my head. I'm like, my entire life revolves around Molly. What do I do?
Yeah.
So it really is like, I need you to, like, you need to wear a helmet and shit. Like, I can't have anything bad happening to you.
Yeah.
So... But yeah, so that was just an odd day. But yeah, so I was a little weird and quirky per usual, but we're good now.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess we should, I haven't done anything else since that.
Yeah, we didn't have our live show. We said that.
Oh,
we're going to try to find some more times later, like in the fall for some live shows, and we'll keep you guys updated.
Oh, I did say I was going to update people about the fish pooping scenario.
There you go.
So it turns out that every fish is a little bit different. Some have like this like tiny hole that shit comes out of, but it's not like a butt, like a butt like ours.
Well,
it's still like an anus of some sort.
It's just like a hole.
Yeah. And then, but I didn't think that some poop through their mouths.
Okay. I didn't think that fish had like butt cheeks.
They don't know what. Okay. But that's what I was trying to figure out.
Okay.
Cause I was like picturing butt picture right now, picture a fish with butt cheeks.
I bet you there's one fish somewhere that does.
Oh.
Like a blobfish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because they're
blobby.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the answer to that. Okay. I did say I was updating. And then you got a puppy.
Yep. I do feel like we talked about that last time.
Did we talk about
Poppy?
I don't know.
Anyways, her name's Poppy.
Poppy the podcast pup.
Yep.
Yeah.
And once she stops stealing everything in the house, we'll bring her up here, maybe.
She takes the shoes couch. And, she brings it on the couch. Like, here you go.
Yeah.
Put those on and get the hell out of here.
Yeah. She's like, take me out.
Yeah. She's really funny. She's very cuddly. She's very cute. Good dog.
Yeah.
But then she gets zoomies.
Yeah.
And she's just...
She just likes to... Like, she kind of chews on things, but she doesn't really chew on them. She just likes to take things.
Yeah. Like,
She's a kleptomaniac.
She's a kleptomaniac.
Yeah. Yeah.
She is. But yeah, so she's very cute though and very sweet and I love her very much.
Yeah, she's a very cute girl. Yeah. She has one ear that stays like up and one that goes down.
Oh, she does something naughty and you want to be like, oh, Poppy, and then she looks at you with that one ear up and one ear down, and you're like, all right, I'm sorry.
You're like, it was my fault. Yeah, actually, somehow. Yeah. Sorry. My bad.
So but yeah, I love her.
Yeah.
So that is some positive news that we've had.
Yeah.
So
it was nice to have a puppy, I guess, in all of this.
Yeah. Everything happens for a reason. So.
Yeah. The therapy dogs have been really awesome.
Have they?
They've been bringing through.
That's good.
Yeah.
Rubbing that in my face, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, you had a puppy. at our house.
I know. I could use a therapy dog all the time, though. I think I'm one of those people that needs one.
Therapy dogs have been such like, good boys
to remind girls. Me to like grab my phone, grab my wallet.
I don't know if they tell you that. I don't think that's
yeah. I need a therapy assistant.
That's like a yeah. That's an assistant dog. That's just like an assistant.
He wears a tie and everything.
Yeah.
We'll call him Frank.
Yeah. He just brings you things. He's like, oh, she forgot this again.
Making copies for me.
And he like groans like that. Yeah.
Oh, you know what? Dakota could be my assistant then because she does that.
She does.
Yeah. Well, I guess we don't really have a whole lot of updates because we are going to take a break from doing lives for the summer.
Yep.
We will get back at it this spring or this fall. And I did talk with Kyle a little bit the day of that whole or the day after that whole scenario. And we're going to sit down and get something put together early enough where we can start advertising to give you guys time to make plans. So that's going to start getting into the works very soon here. And then I have to update the website. I'm going to do that this week.
Yeah. And I want to do an update, too, on, like, top episodes and stuff. We haven't done that in a long time.
I haven't done that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I need to do that. Oh, but I do have here. Oh.
It's always fun to do.
I do have right in front of me here. So we, from last month, we're up another 8%. And we have 15 new followers. And our biggest episode last month was the murder of Joel Guy Jr.
Oh.
So it turns out that our most popular listening time is at 1 p.m.
Oh.
Fun fact.
Interesting.
I don't know what you guys are doing. It's probably...
Lunch?
I don't know, but I don't know.
Yeah, Gold Guy Jr.
But yeah, oh my gosh. The good news is
Joel Guy Jr. That was a gruesome one.
The good news is that we seem to be, every month we seem to get a little bit bigger, which is really cool. So we're getting there.
Keep sharing, keep telling your friends about us.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Like people come up to me and I have no idea who they are. And they're like, I love your podcast, Robin. I'm like, who the fuck are you?
Yep. But we like
But I love it. So
keep telling us.
And then there was somebody I wanted to give a shout out to. And I completely forgot who it is now because they listen. I didn't realize.
The person that posted. Oh, was doing therapy.
Yeah. The guy that's doing. Oh, crap. I wanted to have that in front of me and I didn't. Can you tell them about the placards or the thing he said he's making? I can pull it up quick. That was in the things going around. What was his name? He's making these yard signs. I keep calling them placards. Is that the same word?
I don't know if that's the same thing.
But he's making these yard signs.
Is that the person though?
Yeah, that's the guy who's making it. Mm. He said, "I love your podcast." Remember?
Just wait.
Oh, no. It's the chiropractor. Person. The chiropractor guy. Right? Or no, the therapy guy. See, there's more than one. So there's more than one person that was listening to us. But the therapy guy said that he loved us. And that's why I wanted to give him a shout out. I'm gonna have to leave it up to you to find that. Because I cannot. But, anyway, but yeah, so lots of, I will, if you find it, I'll give him a shout out. But in the meantime, we're going to get started with a murder because that's what we're here for. All right, so I'm up today. Yeah. That's me. I'm Robin. And today I am. And I am doing a serial killer because I, you know, that's what I do. And so today we're going to be discussing the lipstick killer. Okay. All right. William George Herons was unfortunately born into this world on November 15th, 1928. To George and Margaret. His family was quite poor, and this caused his parents to argue a lot. To get out of the line of fire, he would often wander the streets at night in his hometown of Lincolnwood, which is a suburb of Chicago. My favorite city in the world.
You love Illinois.
Ugh. Carrying around the tension and frustration from his parents arguing, he eventually found that stealing from people during these walks would actually bring him some relief. So, night after night, he would walk through his neighborhood and look for things to steal. He started to rack up quite a collection when one night he was stopped by police. He was 13 years old and carrying a loaded gun. Oh God, I just realized that kind of is eerie to think about right now. Sorry. This led to him admitting to 11 burglaries, and he even brought police to a shed where he had stored all of his stolen goods. He had stolen items such as guns, furs, jewelry, and electronics. Due to his age, he was sentenced to the Gibault School for Boys for several months. It was there he would learn nothing because immediately upon release, he was arrested again for theft. This time, he was sentenced to 3 years at St. Bede Academy, which at the time was an all-boys boarding school. However, in the 70s, it became a four-year college. Luckily for William, while he was at this boarding school, he actually did thrive. He was such a good student that in 1945, at the age of 16, he was accepted into the University of Chicago's special learning program. So he just skipped over high school and went straight into college. So that's pretty, you know, we got a smart guy here.
Yeah.
Which can be good or terrifying.
Right. Seems like the smarter someone is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he began his classes in the fall of 1945. However, since his family was poor, they couldn't afford to pay his tuition. So he obtained a job as an usher to cover the costs. But this job also fueled his fire to steal, which he had been doing again since he was released from St. Bede. So he never got rid of the urge to steal from people.
Yeah.
He's a kleptomaniac.
Right. Yeah.
Just like your dog.
Right. Just like Poppy.
However, it wasn't the only thing he had been doing. Before he even began his first course at the University of Chicago, William had already committed a murder at the age of 16.
It's really young.
Yep. On June 5th, 1945, the dead body of 45-year-old Josephine Ross was found in her Chicago apartment. She had been stabbed multiple times, and her killer had wrapped a dress around her head. It was theorized that she had come home to an intruder, and his reaction was to kill her. She had defensive marks and black hairs in her hand, which they believe came from her attacker. Residents say they saw a man hanging around the apartment complex the day of her murder, but nothing came of it at the time. It was noted that nothing was taken from the apartment except for Josephine's life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not known at the time, obviously, that was that Josephine was killed by William. He was 16 years old and at that point just a burglar. Now, he had a break-in under his belt that resulted in murder and no robbery. Even if Josephine's murder was the act of desperation to not get caught, it would eventually light a murderous fire in William. And from that point on, he didn't break into homes to burglarize them. He broke in to kill.
Hmm.
Later that year, on December 10th, 1945, 33-year-old Frances Brown was found murdered in her apartment at the Pinecrest Hotel. She had been shot in the head, brutally stabbed many times, and she had a knife sticking out of her neck. Frances was described as an attractive secretary and a former WAVE member, and WAVE stood for the Women Accepted for Volunteer Emergency.
Oh.
And that was services, I'm sorry. And it was a unit within the Navy back during World War II.
Wow.
Upon the discovery of Frances's murder, police began to put together the similarities with the two murders in the area that had occurred. One being Josephine Ross, and another was the murder of 34-year-old Estelle Carey. Estelle was found in her apartment with her throat slashed. It would eventually become evident that Estelle was killed by her boyfriend, who admitted to her murder and was sentenced to prison for a whopping 8 years. However, However,
well, it was the 40s.
I know. However, this did alert the police to be on the track for a serial killer. So back at Frances's apartment, police noted that no valuables were taken, which was very similar to Josephine as well. However, there was something left behind at Frances's apartment. A note. A message on the wall, written in lipstick, read, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." So my brain here says, "Sir, if you want to be caught, go turn yourself in or stick around the scene next time that you try to kill somebody."
Right.
This is, to me, it's not a cry for help. It's a way to try and pawn off the guilt.
Well, and it's like teasing.
Exactly.
It's like a taunt.
Yeah. Yeah.
It reminds me of like a Batman, like villain, like being like, you know what I mean? Kind of a little bit Well, like, yeah. The Joker or something.
Yeah, right. My only issue is that I just feel like he's not taking, he's trying not to make it sound like he's taking responsibility right. for it.
Yeah.
Like, oh gosh, you have to stop me because I can't stop myself. Like, okay, cool, dude.
Yeah.
But you're a fucker. So police noted the following similarities in the three murders that were all female. That they lived in an apartment, they were unmarried, and they were all stabbed with knives. However, Josephine and Frances both had their bodies cleaned of blood. The newspapers started to compare the murders to Jack the Ripper, which, of course, freaked out everyone in the area. So, again, they did eventually find out that Estelle was murdered from her boyfriend, so it comes down to just the two that they can't figure out. But that's they think the two women, Josephine and Frances, were killed by the same person at this point. Okay? So about a month later, on January 7th, 1946, the parents of six-year-old Suzanne Degnan awoke to find their daughter missing from her bedroom. 6 years old.
Oh, no.
And she's cute. I'll post a picture. A ladder was outside her window, and a note was left behind. It read, "Get $20,000 ready and wait for my word. Do not notify the FBI or police. Bills are in fives and tens. Burn this for her safety." The mayor also received a note that said, "This is to tell you how sorry I am to not get old Degnan instead of his girl. Roosevelt and the OPA made their own laws. Why shouldn't I?" And a lot more. So I'm going to break that down. So the OPA was the Office of Price Administration. And at the time, there was a massive meatpacking strike. Suzanne's father just so happened to be a senior executive at OPA, which made police believe that this was a hit on the family. A hit that would end very badly for them. Not long after the kidnapping, police found Suzanne's head in a sewer, one block away from where she was kidnapped.
Mm.
Yeah. Her torso was then found in a storm drain. Her right leg was found in a catch basin. And her left leg was found in another drain. Upon investigation, blood was found in the drains of laundry tubs in the basement laundry room of a nearby apartment building. About 1 month later, Suzanne's arms were also found in a sewer. So this poor girl was...
Yeah.
Yeah. So now you have these... Essentially, there was three women murdered and now a child, okay?
Right.
Two of the women they think were killed by the same person. They eventually find out that the one woman was killed by her boyfriend. And now we have a completely different
This seems like a case. Different situation.
Yep. Completely. So you're not really technically putting it all together. So keep that in mind that this was... ransom. Somebody wanted money.
Yeah.
There was a strike going on. They targeted the family.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Does not match the other two.
Not at all.
So police became extremely desperate to find the monster who could viciously murder a six-year-old girl. They interviewed 170 people and claimed multiple times to have caught the murderer. The coroner said that the suspect used a very sharp knife to dismember the girl and may have been a doctor or worked within the meatpacking industry.
Uh-huh.
He also mentioned that the girl was dead before she was taken to the nearby apartment laundry room where she was dismembered. Her cause of death was not released, or at least not, they couldn't prove it.
Yeah.
But he did say that she was dead before that happened, I hope. Well, I mean, I hate saying I hope that she was dead, but like, I hope she was.
Oh, absolutely.
But that she must have been so scared though.
Yeah.
Police zeroed in on one man. Hector Verber was a janitor in the building. Even though the evidence did not point in his direction, police were so desperate that they attempted to beat a confession out of Hector. They beat him so badly that his shoulder separated, but he never caved. When it finally became clear that they had the wrong guy, because he could barely speak English, let alone write a ransom note, he gave the following statement through his attorney. "Oh, they hanged me up. They blindfolded me. I can't put up my arms. They are sore. They had handcuffs on me for hours and hours. They threw me in the cell and blindfolded me. They handcuffed my hands behind my back and pulled me up on bars until my toes touched the floor. I no eat. I go to the hospital. Oh, I am so sick. Anymore and I would have confessed to anything."
Man.
Yeah. He successfully sued the Chicago Police Department for $15,000, which, good for him. So, $15,000 back in...
That was a lot back then.
Yeah. And, yeah.
For him, too.
Yeah, exactly. And fucking... Yeah. And I hope every single one of those... Yeah, and you know that these cops didn't lose their goddamn job. Mm-mm. You know they didn't.
Mm-mm.
But it really goes to show you how fucking terrible things were.
No kidding.
By June 1946, there had been multiple leads, false confessions, and over 370 interviews conducted by police. The media had turned on the cops due to their lack of having a suspect in custody, and overall, there's just freaking panic going on.
Yeah.
However, it would all come to an end on June 26th, 1946, when William Ahrens was arrested for attempted burglary. According to Ahrens, he drifted into unconsciousness under questioning and was interrogated around the clock for 6 days. He was beaten and starved. So we're seeing...
Robbie. They did that again.
Yeah, we're seeing a theme here. He was not allowed to see his parents for days because, again, he's a minor. He was also refused the opportunity to speak to a lawyer for 6 days.
All of this isn't legal. Was it legal back then?
I don't know if I'd say it was legal. I think that was back when the cops were always getting away with everything.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. Like, you know, I'm very pro police, but fucking cops were getting away with shit all the way into the 90s.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, let's talk about the Lori Ben Bennett case.
I mean, you can be pro police, but you can't be
against corrupt, yeah.
Yeah. That's like very exactly, wrong to
yeah.
do. Like, but I'm also pro human.
Yeah.
Like, I'm, you can't do yeah, that. To
I'm
people.
Pro police, but if I think you're doing something shitty, I'm going to fucking call you out on it for sure. So, two psychiatrists, Doctors Haynes and Goy, his name is Roy.
No, it's Goy.
It's wow. Roy Grinker gave William sodium pentahol. Oh my God, I hate words I can't say. Pentahol or pentahol. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Sure. Uh-huh. Without a warrant. Either way, they administered something into him without a warrant.
Yeah.
And without his permission or his parents' consent.
Is that like a truth serum kind of thing?
Yep.
Okay.
They interrogated him for 3 hours. Under the influence of the drug, authorities claimed that William spoke of an alternative personality named George, who had actually committed the murders.
Mm-hmm.
Williams claimed that he recalled little of the drug-induced interrogation, and that when police asked for George's last name, he said he couldn't remember, but that it was a murmuring name. Police translated this to Merman, and the media later dubbed him to be the Murder Man. Instead of Merman, it's Murder Man.
Okay.
Like, this whole thing just went from him like, oh, this guy's George. Merman? Murder Man?
Murder Man.
They're so desperate for a fucking answer to this that they're just like, oh.
So they're going to make it what they want
exactly.
it to be.
So on the fifth day in custody,
what? That's what the media does, though, too.
They still do that shit.
And they still do that.
Oh, speaking of, like, I got to tell you, too, real quick, not to jump off topic here, but even with our situation here in town, the fucking media coming up to kids and parents trying to get stories.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
I know. I mean, it's what the media does.
I don't care. I don't know how any of these, and I'm going to quote unquote journalists that do something to that extent can sleep at night. Now, we've worked with great journalists.
Yeah.
The guy that did the newspaper article on us and everything, he's a father. He's down to earth. He writes great stories.
Was he the one that wrote the article for?
I think so.
Yeah, about this.
Yeah. Like, he didn't need to go around and question people about this. He didn't need to get in their faces. He was so respectful, waited for if anyone wanted to talk to him.
Right.
That's how it should be done. Like, no news story is worth hounding people that are traumatized.
Yeah.
It's just fucked up.
Yeah.
So I was real heated about that.
Yeah.
The other day.
You don't get heated about things usually.
I don't. I'm a very calm person.
Very calm and keep it together kind of gal.
Never a mess.
Never.
So on the fifth day in custody, William was given a lumbar puncture, which we know as a spinal tap.
Love those.
Yep.
Love but those. I've had one.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. For your headaches.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was given this without anesthesia.
Yeah.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Neat.
Ugh. Moments later, he was driven to police headquarters for a polygraph test. They tried for a few minutes to administer the test, but it was rescheduled for several days later after they found him to be in too much pain to cooperate. No shit.
Yeah.
When the polygraph was administered, authorities, including State Attorney William Toohey, announced that the results were inconclusive.
On July 2nd, 1946, he was transferred to Cook County Jail, where he was placed in the infirmary to recover. After the truth serum questioning, but before the polygraph exam, William spoke to Captain Michael Aaron, with William Toohey, the state attorney, there as well. He offered an indirect confession confirming his claim while under the truth serum that his alter ego, George, might have been responsible for the crimes.
Yeah.
He says that George, which happens to be his father's first name and William's middle name.
So was it his dad?
No. Had given him the loot to hide in his dorm room. So talking a little crazy right now. But again, I feel like he's trying to take the blame and put it on someone else.
Yeah.
If he did this.
Yeah.
And I don't know why you'd be saying this if you had nothing to do with it. So police hunted all over for this George, questioning William, his friends, his family, and associates, but no one knows who the fuck this George character is, okay? Yeah. So William was attributed as saying, while under the influence, that he met George when he was 13 years old, and that George was would send him out at night to prowl and rob for pleasure, and he killed like a cobra when cornered. And then George, of course, told all this to William. So in William's mind, and at least the way he's talking, this George is a completely different human being. And William's this innocent guy that George is confiding in.
Yeah.
He allegedly claimed that he was always taking the rap for George for petty theft, assault, and now murder. Psychologists explained that at the time, in some way, children make up an imaginary friends. It's very possible that William made up this personality to keep his antisocial feelings and actions separate from the person who could be the average son and student. So who, you know, because he was smart and went off to college at 16. So everyone's like, yeah, you've made some mistake and you've done some stupid shit, but you're really smart. You're going to turn your life around. You're going to be okay. So the psychologist is saying you made up George so that you have your outlet for that addiction that you have of now murder, but robbery. So authorities were skeptical regarding his claims and suspected that he was laying the groundwork for an insanity defense, but the confession earned widespread publicity and they began to call him the murder man. So that was where that nickname came from. He was dubbed the lipstick killer in the newspapers and everything, which is what I went with. So yeah. Even though he only wrote lipstick that one time, I was like, I like that better than Murder Man.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the police some more. So they conducted a search of William's residence and college dorm without a warrant.
Okay.
They found other items that earned publicity. A scrapbook containing pictures of Nazi officials that belonged to a war veteran, Harry Gold. That was taken when Harry's property was burglarized the night that Suzanne was also killed.
So he was busy that night.
He was busy that night. But it also could be said that if he was burglarizing this house, what made him have time to go and pull off such a fucking sting? Because Suzanne was also dismembered that night.
Yeah.
So Gold lived in the vicinity of where Suzanne did. But that put him in the suspicion that he was in that area. Right. So that could go either way if you think about it. He could have been out burglarizing and didn't have the time to do that. Or, and it's just a coincidence that it happened. Or he did both.
Right.
Also in William's possession was a stolen copy of Psychopathia Sexualis. It is a study of sexual deviance by Richard von Krafft-Ebing. Cool. It was written in 1886. I can only imagine what that says. Might have to look it up.
1886.
Yeah, wow. I didn't even know that Psychopathia Sexualis was a thing in the 1880s. But you know what? Go get them.
Yeah.
In addition, in William's belongings, police discovered a stolen medical kit, but they said that the medical instruments could not be linked to the murders.
Yeah.
Okay. No trace of biological material such as blood, skin, or hair were found on the tools. No biological material of the victims were found in William's home, in his clothes, or on himself. The medical kits were also considered to be too fine and too small for the dissection.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, William had used the 4-inch long medical kit to alter the war bonds he had stolen.
Okay.
So a gun was found in his possession that was linked to a shooting. A Colt police positive revolver. God help me, Lord. A Colt police positive revolver had been stolen in a burglary at the apartment of Guy Roddick on December 3rd, 1945. 2 nights later, a bullet crashed through the closed 8th-floor apartment window of Marion Caldwell, wounding her. William had that gun in his possession, and according to the Chicago Police Department, the bullet that injured this woman was linked through ballistics to that same gun. So yeah. That was naughty.
Yeah, that wasn't a good thing.
While handwriting analysis did not definitely link William's handwriting to the lipstick message, police claimed that his fingerprint matched a print discovered at the scene of Francis Brown.
I would also think, like, writing with lipstick.
It doesn't look the same.
Wouldn't be the same as, like, regular handwriting, too. Especially that would be hard to, like, murdered
someone, too. Like, you gotta imagine there's a little bit of shakiness
going on. And, like, writing up on a wall. That would be different than writing, like...
Look at us. We're like, you can't use that as an analysis. You can't use that.
Listen.
We know.
We get that. Understandable.
So it was reported that a bloody smudge on the door jamb somehow matched his fingerprint. So there's pictures of this, and I'm going to show you guys. I personally don't know how they got a fingerprint out of the smudge, let alone claim it's him, but they said that there were 9 points of comparison. However, apparently in the police officer handbook, you can't use that as evidence unless there's 12 points of comparison in a fingerprint.
Oh.
So at least that was at the time.
I was going to say maybe back then
it was
different.
But you know what? Again, they were desperate. So they're like,
they were reaching maybe. They needed something.
Yep. So it could put it would, the 9 points would provide a 65% match to the population.
Okay.
At the time, William's supporters pointed out the FBI has a 12 point and they should have used that, and they ignored it. So there were people that were like, I don't know if this kid did this. This seems extravagant. Yes, he's made mistakes. Yes, he has burglarized. But there's not a whole lot of evidence that's saying this guy did it.
Yeah.
Okay? So on June 30th, 1946, Captain Emmett Evans told newspapers that William had been cleared of suspicion in the Brown murder, as the fingerprint left in the apartment was not his. And that was when 12 days later, they changed their story and said, oh, the bloody smudge is definitely his. So... Because they're realizing, we don't got a whole lot to go off. Right. We can't let this guy go. He's admitted what he's done. Well, his alter ego, friend George, has done it.
Told him about it. Yeah.
So William's defense attorneys felt he was guilty. Which is funny, because don't we always say we're like,
yeah,
these defense attorneys have to be idiots not to see that they're guilty, right?
Yeah.
This is like the one situation where I'm like, I could see that maybe the cops got it wrong here because they're so desperate for a guy to pin this on.
Yeah, but the defense attorney was even like,
I don't know
how to do this.
Yeah, right? So they believed to save Williams from the electric chair, it was to have him admit his guilt and take a sentence. So the small likelihood of a successful murder prosecution of William early prompted the state's attorney office to seek out and obtain the cooperative help of a defense counsel. And the prosecution had in the Deignan case, so the Suzanne, the 6-year-old case, was a partial fingerprint on the ransom note. And it was at this stage of the investigation that the defense counsel moved forward in cooperation. So again, they're looking at this evidence somehow. And even the counsel's like, no, they got you.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here reading this and I'm like, how?
Right.
So
I guess maybe different times and everything.
And it's got to be because now there's like red flags always going up.
Well, and there's just so many more ways to get people now with like the DNA and everything too. And they just didn't have that kind of stuff back then. So maybe it was just so much simpler back then and how to get people that you just needed less. I don't know.
Yeah. So his attorneys, pressured him to take the plea. And the deal was that the topic that in a closed door meeting that Williams would serve one life sentence if he confessed to the murders of Josephine Ross, Francis Brown, and Suzanne Deignan. With the help of his lawyers, he began drafting a confession using the Chicago Tribune article as a guide. So the article was the cases laid out. So they said, here you go. Tell us what you did based off of this article.
you can't do that.
Uh-huh. I know. It's really like they just wanted this to go away and they didn't give a shit whose life was going to be taken down.
They just needed someone.
Real shitty.
They just needed someone to be like, see, we got it.
Yep. As it turned out, the Tribune article was very helpful as it provided me with a lot of details I didn't know. This is what William was saying.
Yeah.
My attorneys rarely changed anything outright, but I could tell by their faces if I had made a mistake, or they would say, now, Bill, is that really the way it happened? And then I would change my story because obviously it went against what was known in the Tribune. So this is crazy to me. Like,
yeah.
And no one's arguing with this. The cops are like, the attorneys, this is what we did. Yep.
Wow.
So both William and his parents signed a confession. The parties agreed to a date.
I can't believe that his parents were like, yeah, I guess so.
I mean, they probably just wanted the whole fucking thing to go away.
Yeah.
The parties agreed to a date of July 30th for William to make his official confession. On that date, the defense went to the secretary's office where several reporters were assembled to ask William questions. And William appeared bewildered and gave noncommittal answers to reporters, which he years later would blame on the secretary and what he was allowed to say and what he was supposed to say.
Yeah.
He would say this. It was Toohey himself. After assembling all the officials, including attorneys and policemen, he began a preamble about how long everyone had waited to get a confession from me. But at last, the truth was going to be told. He kept emphasizing the word truth, and I asked him if he really wanted the truth. He assured me that he did. Now, Toohey made a big deal about hearing the truth. Now, when I was being forced to lie to save my life, it made me angry. So I told them the truth, and everyone got upset. So he kept saying, I didn't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
So that pissed off the secretary. So Toohey withdrew the previous agreed sentence of one life term with a few minor charges, and he changed it to 3 life terms to run consecutively and threatened William with a death penalty if he went to trial. They threatened to charge him with another murder, Estelle Carey, even though William wasn't even around at the time of her murder. He was at that boys' school, so he couldn't have done it, but they were going to threaten to charge him with that, too.
Really?
And they knew that the boyfriend did it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. How fucking awful are these cops? And the attorneys.
Yeah,
And the political system here is just awful. So, Toohey announced that he would press ahead and try Williams for the death of Suzanne Dignan and Francis Brown. So William agreed to the new plea agreement. So that sucks for him.
Yeah.
And it was held again in Toohey's office. This time, William talked and answered questions, even reenacting parts of the murders to which he had confessed. And that was, William said later, I confessed to save my life.
Yeah.
So this is some fucked up shit, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's sad these murders happened, but now it makes you really wonder, did he fucking do this shit?
Right.
So now we're going to talk about, and I'm going to tell you about some evidence, okay? And some things. I have a really hard time believing evidence at this point, too, because of all the shit that led to, like, pin it on this guy. But I also don't know because he did the alter ego thing and, like, what if he was trying not to blame, like, the note, the lipstick note.
And did he ever go under, like, psychological evaluation?
Yeah, but the psychological evaluations were while he was drugged up.
Right.
So it's
and
not.
And that was the only time he did. Okay. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the evidence. The knife. In his confession, William stated that he disposed of the hunting knife with which he said he cut up Suzanne with. He said he cut her up by the subway tracks near the scene of the murder. The police never searched the tracks. However, learning of this, reporters inquired with the track crew if they had found a knife. They had found it on the tracks and they kept it in the Granville Station storage room. So now this is the only thing that kind of freaks me out a little bit because he knew where a knife was.
Yeah, and they found
They found a knife over there. But again, how do we know that the cops aren't lying just to keep things moving forward?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to believe. But that was kind of like, oh, shit. Maybe he really did do this.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty.
Yep. Well, and then it was determined that knife belonged to Guy Roderick, the same guy that had his pistol stolen.
Yeah.
Which was found in William's possession and was the gun used in that shooting. So now again, holy crap, that does kind of
Kind of sync up.
Starts to point in your direction. Yep. So now all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, maybe this guy did do it.
Yep.
And he positively identified that it was his knife. And William told him exactly where to find it. So that's kind of makes you feel a little on edge.
He probably, probably stole that knife.
Yep. So William did take full responsibility for the three murders on August 7th, 1946. The prosecution had him reenact the crime in Suzanne's home in public and in front of the press.
That's what you want.
Yeah, great, right? So on September 4th.
Performance act.
Oh, my God. This is just insane to me. So yeah. On September 4th, with William's parents and the victim's family attending, Williams admitted his guilt on the burglary and murder charges. That night, William tried to hang himself in his cell, timed to coincide during a shift change of the prison guards.
Yeah.
He was discovered before he died. He said later that despair drove him to attempt suicide, which, yep, don't blame you there. I mean, I'm so conflicted. Like, I don't know what to think right now. Everyone believed I was guilty. If I weren't alive, I felt I could avoid being judged guilty by the law and thereby gain some victory. But I wasn't successful at that. Before I walked into the courtroom, my counsel told me to just enter a plea of guilty and keep my mouth shut afterward. I didn't even have a trial. On September 5th, after further evidence was written to the record and the prosecution and defense had made their closing statements, Ward formally sentenced William to 3 life sentences. As William waited to be transferred to Statesville Prison from the Cook County Jail, the sheriff asked William if Suzanne Degnan suffered when she was killed. William answered, "I can't tell you if she suffered. I didn't kill her. Tell Mr. Degnan to please look after his other daughter because whoever killed Suzanne is still out there."
Yikes.
I know! So, which is a part of the thing where I'm like, what if this whole knife thing was just something to keep the thing going?
Right.
Maybe someone was questioning the police and they're like, we need something else. I cannot trust this police force at all. I mean,
it's all very messy.
Yeah. So within days of his confession, Williams denied any responsibility for the murders. I mean, he's already sentenced. So he's like, fuck this. I'm going to just do what I can. The daughter of murder victim Josephine Ross also had this to say about the situation. "I cannot believe that young Mike William murdered my mother. He does not fit the picture of my mother's death. I have looked at all the things William stole, and there was nothing of my mother's among them." So even one of the victim's daughters does not believe this kid did this.
Yeah.
Which, you know, again, could go either way. Some people don't want to believe it. Some people can't believe it.
Well, and just because you don't think that someone did it doesn't mean that they didn't do it
either. Yeah.
For like, I mean, in that case, like, oh, I don't see my mom's things here. That doesn't mean.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just playing devil's advocate with that.
Yeah, like, absolutely. But, right. Yep. So this kid's kind of sad. So soon after William was arrested, his parents and younger brother changed their surname to Hill. So they wanted to just separate themselves from him. And then his parents divorced after he was convicted.
Yeah, it'd be hard.
Yep. William was first housed at the Stateville Prison in Joliet, Illinois. He learned several trades, including electronics and television and radio repair. And at one point, he had his own repair shop in the facility, which, good, okay. Before a college education was available to prison inmates, William, on February 6, 1972, became the first prisoner in Illinois history to earn a 4-year college degree. He received a Bachelor of Arts and later earned 250 course credits by funding the cost of correspondence courses with 20 different universities from his savings.
Wow.
Yep. Passing courses as varied as languages, analytical geometry, chemistry, data processing, tailoring, and physics. He managed the garment factory at Stateville for 5 years, overseeing 350 inmates, and after a transfer to Vienna Correctional Center, he set up their entire educational program. He aided other prisoners' education progress by helping them earn their GEDs and becoming a jailhouse lawyer of sorts, helping them with their appeals.
Wow.
William was given an institutional parole for the Degnan murder in 1965. And in 1966, he was discharged on that case and began serving his second life sentence. So, the sucky part is, if he would have just kind of the first time around, he might have gotten out.
Yeah.
But he's also doing really well in there. I don't know, he wouldn't have wanted to leave. I mean, if you think about it, when you're in jail for that long, that's all you know, especially as a kid. Going out in the real world, that might have sucked.
Right.
So who knows?
I mean, he had his routine, he had his system,
he was helping people.
Yep.
So Although not freed, parole policies of the day meant that he was considered rehabilitated by prison authorities and that the regulations of 1946, Williams should have been discharged from the Brown murder in 1975 and from all remaining charges in 1983. However, in 1973, the focus moved from rehabilitation to punishment, which blocked his chance of getting released.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yep.
In 1983, the 7th District U.S. Court of Appeals ruled that it was unconstitutional to refuse parole on grounds to inmates convicted before 1973. Gerald Cohn ordered Illinois to release William immediately. The brother and sister of Suzanne Degnan went public, pleading with authorities to fight the ruling. Attorney General Neil Hartigan stated, "Only God and William know how many other women he murdered. Now a bleeding heart to do-gooder decides that William is rehabilitated and should go free. I'm going to make sure that kill-crazed animal stays where he is." I'm sorry. Neil Hartigan, if you actually fucking read what happened, you wouldn't be calling him that. There's no fucking proof that he actually did this based off of the police work.
Yeah.
I keep fucking knocking things. It pisses me off. That guy pisses me off.
Yeah.
It's Illinois. The Illinois Senate.
It's Illinois. It's Illinois.
The Illinois Senate passed a resolution that has the confessed murder of Suzanne Degnan, a 6-year-old girl whom he strangled in 1946. So now they're saying that she was strangled. I'm sorry. I searched high and low and could not find any evidence that she was reported strangled. So I don't know if they looked through a file and that's how they decided that she was murdered. But that's where it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
In this guy's statement. That's why I'm like, are we still going with the whole assumption shit here?
Right.
Many years later, but yeah. It is opinion of the chamber that the release of William at this time would be detrimental to the best interests of the people of the state. With the support of prominent politicians, the 1983 court ruling was later reversed. In 1975, he was transferred to a minimum security facility in Vienna, Illinois. And then in 1998, upon his request, he was transferred to the Dixon Correctional Center, which is also a minimum security prison in Dixon, Illinois. He resided in the hospital ward. He suffered from diabetes, which had swollen his legs and limited his eyesight, making him have to use a wheelchair. He continued to try to get released, even while being sick. There was a petition that came out in 2002 from Lawrence C. Marshall, and he was seeking clemency. And then, of course, that appeal was eventually denied. Former Los Angeles police officer Steve Hodel, who had spent 25 years on the force, met William in 2003 when he was investigating the murders. He was convinced that William was innocent of the crimes. He wrote this, "I felt compelled to write an appeal to the Illinois Prisoner Review Board stating my professional belief that William is innocent." William's most recent parole hearing was held on July 26, 2007. The Illinois Prisoner Review Board decision in a 14-0 vote against parole was reflected by board member Thomas Johnson, who stated that God will forgive you, but the state won't. However, the parole board also decided to revisit the issue once per year from then on. However, on February 26, 2012, due to complications from his diabetes, William Ahrens died on March 5th, 2012, at the age of 83.
I was going to say,
never being released.
Yeah.
So here's what I have to say about this. We all know how I feel about Illinois. This sums it up. There is not enough evidence to convict this guy in any way, shape, or form. And as even a police officer who's investigating it in modern times is like, he didn't do it.
Or, like, there wasn't enough evidence to keep him there.
And
like
these fucking parole boards. I swear to God, I want to get on one and just fuck shit up. He gets in 14-0. Not one person on that board thinks this guy is innocent?
Yeah.
Are you dumb? What is...
Yeah.
And look at all the things he did while in jail.
Right.
Like, I just... I can't. My brain... So, I don't think this guy did it. I do think that he did some dumb shit. But I do not think he murdered that 6-year-old girl.
No.
I do not think he murdered. And that was everything's big thing. They're like, we're going off of this. I also don't believe he did the other murders either. I think that because he was burglarizing people. So in the beginning, I say, I'm like, oh, he switched to murder. I don't think he did. I think that's the way the story is telling you, you know? So I don't think he murdered those women. I think he was a kleptomaniac.
So were there other murders after? I mean, of course, I'm saying.
I mean, yeah, they very well could be. But guess what? They ain't gonna fucking talk about it.
Yeah,
and they probably pinned it on other people too.
Right.
But yeah, of course, according to this story and the police evidence, it all went away when they arrested this guy.
Yeah.
No, I think he had some psychological issues. I think he was scared. 16 years old. He had made mistakes. He obviously was robbing people. That's still bad, but not to a point where you're serving 3 life sentences and your entire life is spent behind bars.
Yeah.
Like, he died trying. I just don't believe he murdered that little girl.
Yeah.
I feel so bad that she was murdered. But I believe it was, I think it was exactly what it was. Somebody from that meatpacking industry going after that family. Right.
I think that the cases were too different.
Exactly. He was 16 years old. He doesn't have the training to cut up a body to that precision. Should be your first red flag. And if he was known to have been robbing someone else in that area that night, how on earth could he have had the time to do that, put a ransom together, kidnap this little girl, murder her, and then dismember her all at the same time?
And also, what was his motive for the ransom?
Exactly. Right. Right. Whereas everything that was going on in the meatpacking world, that made sense.
Yeah.
I'm so disappointed.
Interesting.
That this happened.
Yeah.
I feel really bad for the guy. I do.
Yeah.
And I'm a hard ass. You know that.
I know you are.
But I think that he was wrongly convicted.
Yeah.
And So that is, and I say this with air quotes, the lipstick killer. Now, I'm going to tell you about the places that these murders happened. Now, there's not a whole lot to say because they were all in apartments. Because Chicago, suburbs of Chicago and everything, a lot of apartment building style condos, things like that. So the first one, 5943 North Kenmore Avenue, was where Suzanne was, the little girl, was kidnapped from. So that building is still there, and it is condos. Then there's 5901 North Winthrop Avenue, which is where she was dismembered. So that was the basement where she was dismembered.
Yeah.
Those are now condos, and they're priced at about $400,000 a piece. Okay?
Yeah.
I don't know what the basement looks like. 3941 Pine Grove Avenue is where Frances Brown was murdered, and her building is still there as well. Still is apartments. 4108 Kenmore Avenue is where Josephine Ross was murdered, and that's also condos now, and they are about $350,000 apiece. So one thing to keep in mind, too, is that all of these happen in the same area.
Yeah.
So if there was someone that was doing this, they essentially probably got away with it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if they took off after that and maybe went on to murder elsewhere. Maybe... I mean, that's the thing. It's like, if I were a cop and I didn't have anything else to do with my life right now, or if I was a retired police officer, Spigola, look into this, I would be pulling this as much information as possible to see where else murders like this happened and that are unsolved or were pinned on someone.
Yeah.
Makes you wonder, you know?
Yeah.
But I definitely think the Suzanne Degnan is completely different from the other two cases.
Yeah.
So this is the first one I think I've done where I don't think that this kid was guilty of any of these.
And that you wanted him to get out.
And I wanted him to get out.
Yep.
I don't think he was guilty. I think he needed to work on his little robbery problem. A little therapy wouldn't hurt.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, maybe getting, you know, maybe play hide and seek with your own things. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, that's the story.
Maybe he wasn't ready to leave his home.
Yeah. And you know what sucks, too? I wish that someone would look further into this and try to somehow, if there was a way to prove that he didn't do it, and then have his name, like, cleared.
Yeah.
That's what I think should happen. So somebody do that. I don't have time. I can't do
Someone do it.
I don't have time. Somebody else do it. So. Any questions?
I'll take questions from the audience.
That was one of my longer ones.
I know.
There's a lot of information about that. But I told you, I'm like, there's a lot that happened afterwards.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, well, good job. Thanks.
Yeah. That was interesting.
It was something.
Yeah. Too bad. But I mean, it sounds like at least he was able to lead a productive and like, hopefully a fulfilled life in prison.
You know what I mean? I hope so. I mean, yeah.
As much as one can.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and I really believe in the rehabilitation process.
Yeah.
So you know me. I still am very firm on if you take a life, I don't think, if you maliciously take a life, I do not think you should get to go out and live your life. I really don't. I will stick to that. But I've met people, inmates, that are turning their lives around and doing what they can and trying to help the community, and because I believe in rehabilitation.
but I still don't believe in enough that you should be free if this soul you took can't be free.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about that.
But yeah, but just hearing what he all did while he was there, so it sounds he made the most of what he
could. So if he was just, if he legit was just some burglar, then get in, get your help, learn a little bit more about life, get your shit together, and then he should have gotten out.
Yeah.
So, but somebody needs to clear that guy's name.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I will see you guys again someday.
Someday soon.
Yeah.
Somewhere out there.
I'm going to go do an open house now.
Yay.
I'm going to go sell it. Don't forget, if you need your home sold, we do sell real estate as well. And we'd be very happy. We'd be very happy to talk about murder while we're trying to sell your home. If that's what you want.
If that is what you want, we can do that.
So, all right, guys, have a great week. And we will see you next time.
Yep. We will be back.
I think.
We will.
Good.
Great.
Love you.
Bye.